Very good. Well, welcome everybody, and especially welcome to Dr. Tucker. Dr. J. Lee Tucker is the director of the Center for Digital Health and Wellness at the University of Florida, also professor and chair of the Department of Health Education and Behavior in the College of Health and Human Performance there. Did I get that right, J. Lee?
Yes, you did.
Wonderful. I'm very excited. I've just developed an interest over the last year in behavioral economics, and I've always been interested in public health. So I am just happy to start by asking you to tell us, just tell us what you think is important for us to know. There are students on the line, there are faculty on the line, and there are postdocs on the line, all eager to hear your thoughts.
Well, before we get into particulars, I really am kind of curious who is in the audience. I mean, mainly psychologists? Are there any non-psychologists on the call?
Ben and Tessa are on here. We're from HEB.
Okay. That's close enough. But do we have a mix of people who are in clinical psychology and other areas of psychology, perhaps?
Clinical psychology here.
Clinical here.
Clinical.
Organizational psychology.
I'm a practitioner.
Is Tom Horvath on the line?
Good morning, Jay Lee. Yes, there's five of us here.
Oh, wonderful. It's wonderful to hear your voice. Okay. Well,
Tom,
what about...
great to hear your voice.
Oh, thank you. Has anybody ever taken a course in public health and epidemiology? Okay. that might be a good place to start, Bruce. What do you think?
I think it's wonderful. There are some new people on the line, so I ask you, please, everyone, press your mute button now, because even shuffling a paper, knocks on doors, are all cumulative, so at some point we won't be able to hear J. Lee if you don't put your mute button on. And of course, when you speak, take it right off if you have a question or a comment. So if everyone please mute their phone, even I do that. So we are ready, J. Lee. That's wonderful.
Well, I think the place to start is to just mention that I was trained as a clinical psychology in a very experimentally oriented program a long time ago at Vanderbilt when Mark and Linda Sobel were there. And so I very much started out in a clinical treatment outcome worldview. I took psychotherapy with Hans Strupp, which was one of the major initiators of evidence-based research on treatment effectiveness that continues to this day to influence how we ask those kinds of questions. And I stayed in that kind of framework, if you will, for a long time, and then I started getting real frustrated with it. And I mention this because, as many of you are aware, during the late 70s, well into the 80s, there was the controlled drinking controversy in the alcohol field. There was just this tremendous argument about, you know, is my treatment better than your treatment, the whole horse race comparative treatment outcome agenda. And Project Match was the culmination in our field of that research agenda. But somewhere along the line, I was reading an article written by Betsy Tom, who is an old British alcohol researcher, and it was on help seeking. And I had this light bulb go on, which now I think is kind of common knowledge, and that is that you can have the most effective treatment in the world or efficacious treatment in the world, but if you can't get people to use it, it's not going to have any impact on outcome, much less population health. And the UK healthcare system has always been much more of a single-payer system that was based on rational decision rules about treatment seeking and coverage, whereas the U.S. has been much more pluralistic until very recently. And so I read that, and it was just like, wait a minute, you know, we're really missing the forest for the trees here. I mean, we've got this huge evidence base, which now is only larger, that shows us of intervention components that lead to good outcomes. But the issue is there's still this big gap between service utilization, between the people in need of those services and who ends up in treatment systems or other forms of help, including mutual help groups. I mean, the gap, depending on the studies you read, is 10 to 25%. And so that reoriented my thinking at the time to, okay, how do we understand that and how do we approach that in order to remediate it so that we can get good treatments to the people that need them? And I think at the time I was not unusual in, you know, coming to these kinds of realizations, because in 1990 the Institute of Medicine published what is an incredibly important book in our field, Broadening the Base of Alcoholism Treatment. And if you have that chapter that I had Bruce post on the website handy, it's figure one. And again, you know, I apologize, this may be old news for many of you, but if you haven't been exposed to it before and you haven't taken an epidemiology class, I think looking at that figure, which is a population perspective on substance use, substance-related problems and interventions, is, you know, it really tells a story here. And the important point is that most people who are in psychology and that are coming at the world from a clinical worldview, you are in the tail of the distribution in the population with the most severe problems. And so that's that little tip. Those of you that can see this, the triangle that's on its side here, you are dealing with individuals who are the minority who have severe problems. And when you start thinking about things from a population perspective, you quickly realize that the bulk of harm and cost of these problems comes from the mild to moderate majority in the population. And this, of course, our field has been, I think, you know, very in tune with this, with the development of brief interventions and to try to deliver those kinds of interventions to risk groups like college students and so forth. But that's a new development, and historically we have tended to operate collectively in the tails of the distribution. We have generally had intensive clinical treatments, which is an acute care model, or we've been doing universal prevention, such as Project DARE. And what public health suggests is we need to be concerned with the middle of the spectrum of problem severity. So I'm going to shut up now and let Bruce ask me a question or somebody
else. Oh, my goodness. Jaylee, I bought that book when it came out, and it sits on my shelf. I just went over and got it, and I found the original on page 212. That is such a really, really good point about the fact that we only pay attention, or we mostly pay attention, to the tail of the distribution. I think if you keep going, you'll do just terrific. So tell us more about, bring together the work you've been doing with behavioral economics and public health.
Hey, Bruce, or Jaylee, before we continue, I just want to remind everyone to put their phones on mute. I know a few people came on in the middle while Jaylee was talking. So if you're out there and you're listening, if you can mute your phone, that'd be great.
Thank you, Lauren. I thought that, and I'm glad you said it. Unless there are questions, that's a very important figure that you brought to our attention. And if any of you don't have access to that that we've posted online, take a look later. Jaylee, do you want to go on and tell us more?
I can keep going. Before I actually get into the behavioral economic applications from a public health or population perspective, I really do want to emphasize that part of what we're trying to figure out here is how do you cover the population in need with a spectrum of services that fits their needs. And if you go back and read some of the newer work in the prevention area on approaches to prevention, There are generally three kinds of prevention. There's the universal prevention approach, which is what I've already described with Project DARE, and that's kind of the bread and butter, if you will, of like epidemiology, where they, you know, going out and they're doing these mass media campaigns that are dispersed broadly over the population without really any regard to audience characteristics or risk factors. And then there's indicated prevention, which really kind of melds into intervention and treatment, but there's in between selective prevention, and that's really where I've kind of come to. And what it is you try to make use of what we know as psychologists about individual behavior change. I mean, I think that is the one thing that psychologists are truly the expert at. We understand behavior change, and much better than people in public health do. And in fact, that's one of the things that when I got in public health, I mean, I found their notions about that to be pretty simple-minded. But they have tools that pertain to dissemination that psychology doesn't have. And so selective prevention tries to use the tools of public health about how do you reach risk groups, how do you identify risk groups, how do you find contact points and teachable moments to deliver interventions that have the best elements of effective behavior change interventions, but are not overly long duration. They're not psychotherapy. They're, you know, brief motivational interventions are a great example of this. But the art of this in public health practice is you need to figure out the capture points, like how to find these people. And they generally use things that are based on social marketing principles, and they talk about trying to do market segmentation. And all that means when it's applied in the context of health and health risk is you want to find groups of people, not necessarily individuals, but groups of people that have higher than average risk that could benefit for interventions that are targeted to their risk characteristics and needs. So this is not necessarily tailoring, which is truly individual, but you are nevertheless finding risk groups, paying attention to risk factors and preferences and need, and then adapting your intervention to match that. And that's public health. It's different than a lot of clinical interventions in that they pay an awful lot of attention to consumer preferences. They don't ignore that, whereas historically the clinical worldview has been the doctor is right. You know, I'm going to tell you what is good for you, and here's my treatment, and you better adhere to it. Public health that makes no such assumption. It's much more opportunistic, and they attempt to find people, for example, motivational brief interventions in emergency departments, you know, finally have got the healthcare system up to speed about when people come in with accidents and injuries to check blood alcohol levels and other potential drug use. And for those who screen positive, you know, to do that kind of brief intervention at that sort of capture point. Another example from public health is this is why you do vaccination when kids go to school. It's not that there's anything special about getting vaccinated when you're 5 or 6, as much as that is a capture point where, you know, almost all the children are going to have to go through an organizational process where you can actually, you know, document that they received the vaccines in order for them to go to school. So again, it's different, if you will, than a typical psychotherapy model. You know, back in the old days with psychodynamic psychotherapy, you know, you talked about you wanted to make sure that the patient had intrinsic motivation and that those were the best psychotherapy candidates, and you wanted to reserve your limited treatment spots for the people that were highly motivated and were anxious and so forth, that they were going to be the best psychotherapy candidates. That is a very high threshold model of access to care, whereas public health is deliberately low threshold. They don't want to make it hard for people to get services. And they want to, if you will, you know, reduce the obstacles for people to seek services. And so in the addiction area, one of the, I think, most exciting changes that has happened in the time that I've been in the field is that we now have many more services that are easier for people to access. The whole movement away from inpatient residential treatment services to outpatient services to people being able to get resources online, and then of course all kinds of mutual help groups have expanded. But moving out into the community and having more contact points for screening and brief intervention and referral is really a critical element of trying to increase access to services and reduce barriers to services. And that's where this whole thing connects with digital health applications. But again, I think I'm going to stop there and let somebody comment or ask questions.
Jaylee, I would like to jump in. I want to tell people the chapter you wrote is easily accessible right in the middle by clicking on the link in the middle of the page on our website, our blog. It's really a terrific chapter. Jaylee, I'm looking at the page where you describe the three-pronged approach, universal prevention, selective prevention, and indicator prevention, because you just told us about those. And I'm thinking about my interest in gambling studies, my interest in looking for problem gambling. It's an area that is just barely tapped, and it seems like it's an area that would be so ripe for what you're talking about. So I'm wondering what you think about perhaps how that triangle from the people who have the most severe problems, the people who don't have the problems, how we might figure out who falls in each category in gambling. And I'd also be curious about examples of, like, universal prevention might be for which group and how. Would it be like TV commercials for everybody to go, gambling's fun, but if you have a problem, you know what I'm asking. So do you mind applying that to gambling and speculating a little bit?
Well, Bruce, I'm not an expert in gambling, okay? And so I hesitate to get too specific about that sort of thing.
Oh, just the concepts I think would be interesting, like even if it's not specifically gambling, like how do you apply the idea of universal prevention if you think there's a big group of people out there with a problem?
I'm not a big fan of universal prevention. I mean, I know there's a place for it, and I think that that's something that the federal government has done about as good a job as anybody in doing that sort of thing. An example of that are the current smoking ads that they show of the poor people that have had, you know, terrible health consequences from smoking. Terry, I'm sure most people have seen those sort of things. That's an example of universal prevention, but do notice that they are using the extreme face of the disorder. When they use those kind of ads, the shock value, when they do universal prevention. And the problem with that kind of approach is that it a lot of people look at things like that and they say, well, that's not me. I don't have that kind of problem. They don't relate to it. It's like their risk levels are nowhere near to that extreme. And I am more talking about trying to find people who have, you can call them, you know, sub-threshold, preclinical disorders, but, you know, people that as a group are at risk, like live in a neighborhood that has a casino. I mean, the whole issue of access drives a lot of this kind of behavior, so you can put people in geographic locations that have a high density of liquor outlets where the price of cigarettes and alcohol and other illicit substances is relatively low, that are, if you will, market dense for these sort of things. That would be a good target group for selective prevention. And I don't think I've really answered your question.
More than you think. I mean, just mentioning that selective prevention might occur by by paying a special attention to places where there might be casinos, if there's a casino in your community. So you actually did. Anything further on indicated prevention? Is that all about screening? And is that all about screening and then?
Yeah, and screening is an art form of its own. There are whole books written on how to do good screening, you know, because you got to have something to offer people if they screen positive. I mean, you know, there's a whole issue of, do you really have good screening indicators that are sensitive and specific for a disorder? Because you don't want false positives and you don't want to be missing people. But when you identify people, you've got to be able to refer them or give them some kind of tool or assessment, or assistance, or what's the point? And that's where, you know, a lot of historically psych assessment's been kind of a dead end, because, you know, you could talk and describe problems all day, but then what do you do?
Very good. You may think you're not answering my questions, but as you say words like screening, I just think about how we screen for gambling problems. So you're doing a better job of answering my questions than you realize. I'm going to open it up for questions before you move into behavioral economics, and I'll warn you in advance, there's always a long pause because everyone's afraid they're going to fall all over each other. So I would like to have questions from people online, and there are more than 25 people listening, so please jump in.
Tom, why does this topic interest your group? I'm curious and appreciative.
Well, I've wanted to bring the vocabulary of behavioral economics into our discussions more than heretofore we have, and I thought this was a great way to do that, and also just to hear your overview of the field. Your opening introduction was really quite helpful. I remember reading also the Broadening the Base of Treatment for Alcohol Problems. I just did a retrospective review of it because it's 25 years old as of
the
And the book reads as if it was written last week, which is, to me, pretty scary. We're delighted to be here and listening to you.
Well, thank you. But, you know, whenever there's a change, a sea change in the worldview as there was from that 1990 book, I mean, that was a major reorientation. It takes generations before that becomes the new world view and the operations and tools and interventions catch up to it. There has been movement. I mean, I am very delighted at the leadership role, for example, that NIAAA has taken with their screening toolbox and, you know, how to try to get that into primary care. I mean, just, you know, one simple question about a drink, how much did you drink? And then, you know, they tell you what to do after that. I mean, there has been, I think, some important developments. And, of course, as usual, the issue is, you know, how well have they diffused into the practice community and what are the adoption rates? And you know, that's the whole agenda of implementation science. Anyway, other questions, please. Well, do you want me to move into the behavioral economics of alcohol and other addictive behavior patterns?
I think that'd be wonderful, especially since there's so much more good work being done on that. You talked about it taking generations. It's been a long time since the original. You were involved in some of the original work in this area, and it's really gained momentum, I think, in the last few years. So, if you would, that'd be wonderful. Just defining some concepts that people hear and don't probably know about yet, even as simple as defining behavioral economics and delay discounting and choice architecture, and those are all really, I think, important. They should be in our vocabulary.
Okay, well, when I started reading this stuff, It was back around 1980, and this area got its start in the operant psychology lab at Harvard. And these were some people who were either Skinner students, postdocs, or had worked with him. The main names that you will see out of that era are Herrnstein and Howard Racklin. And then they started working with some economists. And they realized very early on that the concepts in consumer demand theory and microeconomics is conceptually aligned with the reinforcement operations that take place in the kind of experimental studies that people do on choice behavior in the animal lab. So this is what is so, for me, fascinating about this area, is it truly started in the basic behavioral science, in psychology, and then it connected with economic principles, and over time this became known as behavioral economics. But the fundamental question in both of these fields is, how do people and animals allocate their limited resources among the different options that are available in their environment? And so we all have limited resources, whether it's our time, whether it's our money, whether it's the amount of effort that we can spend on obtaining access to a given activity or doing it or a given commodity. And what this whole framework is about is understanding how individuals and animals allocate their resources to different available activities and commodities in the environment or the context of choice. And one of the sort of fundamental facts, and I love to be able to say that because we don't have that many facts in clinical psychology, but one of the fundamental facts is that patterns of choice are context dependent. They are changeable if the context of choice changes. So your relative preference for a given commodity or activity, like drinking or using drugs, is going to change depending on what else is available in the context of choice. And so I think this is very different from older views that assume that the reinforcing properties of substances reside exclusively in the substance, which of course is the assumption of all sorts of, you know, supply-controlled approaches to drug control policy. It's like, you know, the problem is the substance. Let's get the substance out of the environment, and then we won't have a problem. Well, ignoring for the moment the fact that you couldn't do that even if you wanted to in the real world, yes, what substances do pharmacologically matters, but what is critically important is what else is there available out there for people to do over what time frames, at what cost, and so forth. And so one of the most, I think, for intervention purposes, powerful findings that's come out of this literature is, first of all, you can do manipulations on access to the substance itself. And in the parlance of economics, that's what are called own price elasticity of demand relationships, which you know, if you increase the cost of using substances, diminish the access to substances, yes, within a certain range, you can alter substance use patterns and reduce it. The problem, though, if you exclusively rely on those, you'll create black markets. And you see that all the time when you know, look at, oh, gee, you know, they changed the laws and they've made severe criminal penalties for this kind of drug. Well, the next thing you know, there's a new drug out there that is pharmacologically a close cousin. And, you know, the people are very creative at creating and marketing new drugs. So that approach in isolation does not work well. What you have to also be concerned with are what are called cross-price elasticity of demand relationships. And what that means is that you can alter substance use by changing what is out there in the environment. And one of the best ways to do it is to enrich the environment with other valued activities that have benefits for people longer term. And I remember back in the first Clinton administration, they got laughed, you know, out of the room for proposing this, but it actually was good behavioral economics, and that was their midnight basketball program that they wanted to do in inner city neighborhoods that had at that point in time terrible crack and cocaine problems. They wanted to provide a positive activity that was available at a time where there was a lot of drug trafficking and drug use going on. That's an example of, you know, paying attention to the context of choice and the behavioral patterning over time and in different contexts. Another example of that is that one of the riskiest times for adolescents and, you know, teenagers is the period of time when school lets out before parents get home for dinner and that sort of thing. There's a lot of really risky behavior that goes on then. That's another example of understanding the context of use and targeting a risk period with a group that is at risk for intervention. These are examples of paying attention to what is going on elsewhere in the environment. And so behavioral economics has very much taken these concepts and run with them with regard to the development of interventions for alcohol and drug abuse and other addictive behaviors. And I guess to get into some of the basics of that, I imagine most everybody's heard of delayed discounting. That, of course, is the most common, if you will, choice bias. I think the other important thing to take away from this is that these things are normative. Everybody does it. It's just that people with certain kinds of problems tend to have more extreme biases in the nature of their choice. And when we're talking about choice, we're talking about patterns of behavioral allocation through time. We're not talking necessarily of a cognitive process. Clearly that's going on too, but what we're talking about is how do they choose to allocate their behavior. And one of the common features is that everybody discounts delayed rewards. And if somebody asks you, do you want $100 today or $100 in a week, you want it now. But there are a lot of individual differences in the rate of delayed discounting. And people who have addictive behavior problems of many different kinds, they tend to be steeper discounters. In other words, the value decays far faster as a function of delay than it does for people who exhibit, if you will, better behavioral self-control. And that's, again, an important concept. And when people, if you read this literature, they talk about behavioral impulsivity. That's what they're referring to, is how quickly value of delayed rewards decays. They're not talking about this as a personality trait in the way that traditional personality theories have talked about impulsivity. And most of the research shows that those are not highly correlated concepts. So to use, again, a term out of the behavioral economic literature, it's very much concerned with what is referred to as intertemporal choice. In other words, you're doing something now that's going to have effects on your behavior and what you get now, but it's also going to have effects on your behavior and what you get later. And that is the nature, if you will, of addictive behavior patterns. And that is this, you know, kind of chronic preference for short-term, immediately reinforcing commodities that have delayed harmful effects. And so there are a number of ways you can go in trying to work with that fundamental issue. And in the applications in behavioral economics, you've seen a lot of different ways that people have approached this. One is, and I think this is very kind of common psychological, psychotherapeutic approach, is to try to remediate the choice bias. Some of the work that Warren Bickel and his colleagues have done on working memory training, you know, they have shown that they have interventions where you can get people to not discount delayed rewards as steeply. And, you know, that's really trying to remediate the choice bias. But the other way to think about this is to accept that bias choice is normative. I mean, people are going to do it, and to instead try to create context of choice that enables people to make a more beneficial decision and choice. And if you're really good at this, you do it in such a way that it helps the most impulsive people the most without infringing on the overall utility of what's available as a reinforcer or a reward, and that doesn't infringe on the rights and choices of people who do not have as much of a bias in their choice. So this gets into the whole issue of treatment on demand, which I think is a wonderful development in this country that came out of the HIV initiatives that were out in San Francisco in the 80s. But the whole idea, which has been expanded into the alcohol and drug field, is that people who have these problems, depending on where they are in time in relation to the availability of substances and consequences that they've incurred, both good and bad, they will genuinely want to give up their abuse of drugs. I mean, any of you that have done clinical work with people who have these problems, you know that they are sincere, they mean it, they're not lying, but then they get in a different context and they're going to have these preference reversals. And they relapse, and then they regret it, and they want to quit again. And I think an important point here is to realize that's not some kind of trait about them, but it has to do with the variability of choice across different contexts and through time. And so treatment on demand is very opportunistic in a public health kind of way, where when people's motivation shifts away from drug use in favor of wanting to become sober, you want to make it easy for them to get in and get some help while they're having that motivational shift, because it will shift again. That doesn't mean that there's something wrong with their intrinsic motivation. It's just that is just the nature of addictive behavior problems. So treatment on demand is at every level is an intervention that is very congenial with a behavioral economic approach to this, about changing the context to support a better choice. Another way that this is done.
Wait, Jaylee?
Yes.
You've said so many things. I just want to make sure people's brains are caught up, because I remember learning all this stuff, and now that I know it, every time you mention a phrase, I think, oh, I know what you're talking about. But just to go back over a few things, is that okay with you?
Oh, no, please.
Yeah.
Please.
So for anyone who, when you talked about paying attention to the environment, a lot of people don't know about how profound the effect is of that kind of the richness of rewards often determines where people's attentions lie. And I'm thinking about like Rat Park, where they took rats that had nothing, and then they gave, was it cocaine? And the rats absolutely got addicted. But when they created on demand all kinds of other rewarding experience, the rats, the addiction level disappeared. People returning from Vietnam in that famous study that had so much more to choose besides being at war or being in Saigon, they had. So there's a lot of good examples that I don't know if everybody understands how profound that environmental impact, the enrichment of opportunities in the environment. That was one thing I thought was really important, and if there are questions, I hope people will ask. I'm not sure everyone understands delayed discounting, and maybe understanding it more as the importance of immediate gratification or immediate relief versus waiting. And so these are just ideas I'm throwing out. And one other thing, you talked about treatment on demand. Just like 12-step programs have sponsors, I suspect that Tom could tell us a thing or two about Smart Recovery and how they've addressed the importance of treatment on demand. So I'm just, these things are so exciting to me, but I remember when I didn't understand all the concepts and my head would spin. I'm thinking if anybody is in that situation, now is a really good time to respond. So I hope that's helpful. Tom, do you guys have thoughts on providing services to where people are at when immediately, which is, I think, Jaylee, I think that's what you're talking about here, the importance of having that accessible.
One option Smart Recovery has is a 24/7 chat system on the website, which usually has several dozen people on it. So people can get to that, and we're hoping to develop an app so that you can actually easily get to it with one touch from your phone, I hope within the next year or two. And at some point, Jaylee, if you would talk some more about the distinction between impulsivity as a personality characteristic and this alternative way of thinking about it, because I'm still grappling with trying to understand the clinical implications of that, as well as any update on the work regarding expanding working memory.
Oh, okay. Tom, what you're doing about the access from the phone at any time of day or night is beautiful. And I think in general, a lot of treatment systems, even ones like Bradford, have become much more tuned in to getting to people quickly when they get those phone calls, that somebody is really in need and needs help. And again, that is a huge change in my career life. I mean, back in our early days, there were wait lists, and and part of that was a capacity issue, but it was also, I think, the presumption that people had to become abstinent before you'd even let them in the door. And what you're talking about and making it easy for people to get help, and the hook doesn't always work, but they can try it again later if it doesn't work this time. So I think that's very important. But back to the issue of...
Hey, Jaylee, can I jump in and just give some input from some experience?
Sure.
I've had? This is Phil Stillman from University of South Dakota. I just wanted to tell you quickly about this project that I was involved with a few years ago called Support Buddy, where we basically made a tool for Android, iPhone, and Facebook, where people would make their own social support network, and just with a click of a button from their phone, if they weren't doing well, a text message would be sent to their sponsor, an email to their family member, and their friends could see their status in real time on the app. And so we actually had people on the app and using it, and we did find that people were reaching out and actually getting support, quicker, a lot more quickly than they probably would have been if they had been calling their local mental health agency or things like that. So I think that's definitely, we had some proof of concept. So I really hope that this product that I just heard about will take things in that direction and keep going with that.
Well, I think what you're talking about is both our present and our future, because addictive behavior problems are, chronic relapsing and remitting disorders, and people can go for long periods of time and do very well, but when they get in trouble, they're in trouble and they need it now. And that's one of the reasons I like a step care model so much for thinking about these disorders. And I think being able to provide that kind of, I'm going to call it an extensive, digital platform to support people, to be able to monitor for long, extended periods of time where they can be, hooked into what they need quickly when they need it. I mean, I see this as being important on both the front end and the back end of any kind of treatment intervention. And for some people, you don't even need the treatment intervention. You need the hook, and then you need the extensive monitoring, self-monitoring, and guided self-change. I mean, that's what this Center for Digital Health and Wellness that I'm involved with here, that's what they're all about, and multiple areas of health problems that have a big behavioral component to it in terms of being able to maintain health gains and so forth. So, I mean, I do think that from both a research perspective and a clinical perspective, getting this, if you will, digital infrastructure to underpin everything that we do and have it to be more seamlessly and properly connected to helping resources, both in the formal and informal helping system, is really what we're trying to do right now. I mean, we're trying to, if you will, create a new, I don't even want to call it a healthcare system. It's a system, it's a pluralistic system of helping resources that that spans both the professional and the lay and community sectors. But that's an example of letting the impulsivity work for you. Having the phone there, when they need help, they can get it. They don't have to think about it. They don't have to make a doctor's appointment and wait for 2 weeks.
Very good. Are you looking for more questions, or would you prefer to go on?
No, happy to have questions.
Dr. Tucker,
it's
Bennett Tetcha here. Can you go over a little bit more the difference between delayed discounting and impulsivity?
Oh, okay. Yeah, Tom asked that. I'd prefer to talk about personality conceptions of impulsivity in a psychometric sense, the traditional sense that you have the scales that I think most of us are familiar with, and what is referred to in this literature as behavioral impulsivity, and that is really defined by the behavior pattern. You're not making an inference about a personality trait, which is what is measured typically in, you know, like, the Barrett impulsivity scale. I mean, there are quite a few of them out there. When you do studies, and I've done these studies, and you include the traditional personality measures of impulsivity, I mean, you know, they're scales, in the MMPI even. I mean, that whole body of literature, we've known for decades, going back to the 60s, that there is not good evidence of an addictive personality. That was certainly something that they searched for exhaustively for a long period of time, and it's just not there as a stable constellation of trait-like characteristics of people to be related to a pattern of addiction and addictive behaviors. So the behavioral impulsivity notion is you are measuring people's choices that pertain to the problem behavior. And so to give you some concrete examples experimentally, the kind of tasks that people used to assess that kind of concept, one, of course, are the delayed discounting tasks that are all over the literature, whether it's hypothetical or done with real rewards, you are getting people to make a series of choices of different amounts of money typically available at different delays, and you are trying to find out what are called equivalence points when the same amount of money at one delay is equal to a different amount of money at a different delay. In other words, where are people indifferent? And that's what gets plotted on a discount curve, and I know I'm getting off into the minutiae here, but that's where K-parameters come from. But you're looking at how steeply the value is lost of delayed rewards. That's what a discount task does. And you plot that. It's an accelerating downward curve. The slope of it is a K-parameter. Great individual differences in K-parameters that predict things like treatment outcomes and addiction treatment. That's one example of a measure of behavioral impulsivity. Another measure of it is the alcohol purchase task that people like Jim Murphy and James McCallop have developed and have used extensively, and I think it's probably been adapted to smoking and probably some other kinds of substance use. But what they do in that task, has anybody used these things, either of these?
Actually, we are using it in MOST, which is the Marijuana Outcomes Study Team, MOST, in over 11 universities doing research on marijuana, and that's one of the instruments we have in our battery. There's a modification of Murphy and McKillop's demand task. So, yeah.
And I'm using the alcohol purchase task in my thesis.
Excellent. Well, what you're doing with that task, it's an analog, you know, laboratory-based measure, and you are looking at own price elasticity of demand relationships. In other words, how do changes in the hypothetical price of drinks, ranging from they're totally free up to usually around $20 a drink, how sensitive is demand for drinks as a function of changes in price? And again, there are a lot of individual differences in that. And, you know, some people, and you see this in the literature on the use of taxation and costs for cigarettes, you're looking at whether or not the demand for those things is relatively price insensitive. So, like, if somebody's really dependent, they'll keep buying cigarettes even as the cost goes up. They're just going to get them. Whereas with younger smokers who are not as physically dependent, they are much more price sensitive. So those kind of interventions work well with less dependent users to alter the price. And again, that's an own price elasticity manipulation. But that's another task that is increasingly well established and used in this literature and is a measure of behavioral impulsivity. And then one of the things that we have done in our own work, and again, I mainly work at this point with people in the community and in the natural environment, and most of the research I do is looking at patterns of natural recovery from alcohol problems that not among treatment-seeking samples, mainly because they are the majority of problem drinkers out there, and they, for different reasons, don't want to access substance abuse services. But one of the things that we have looked at is how people spend their money. And we look at their relative discretionary expenditure on alcohol and other commodities like recreation, entertainment, other consumable goods, smoking, gifts, and savings. And we look at these patterns comprehensively while they're actively engaging in problem drinking. And one of the things that we have found, that there's some reports now from some new investigative groups, is that people, even when they're drinking like a fish, okay, people who are still able to plan for the future and save money, relatively speaking, even if their traditional diagnostic values on alcohol dependence scales, problem drinking scales, and so forth are the same, the people who are able to allocate money voluntarily to saving for the future are much more likely to be able to stay resolved at follow-ups as long as even 2 years. And interestingly, that relationship is strongest for people who are able to achieve stable moderation drinking patterns. So that's the main thing we've done. But again, we're using real money that based on real behavior patterns over long periods of time in the natural environment to try to look at the relative strength of preference, if you will, for the substances versus engaging in other commodities and activities. But again, that's another measure of, if you will, the allocation patterning, which is how people look at choice and impulsivity and self-control from this behavioral economic perspective. And the last thing I want to say is that there have been some very recent reports in the literature, one of which comes out of Jim Murphy's group, and then there has been some work done with Warren Bickel's group where they too have started looking at monetary resource allocated to the substances as a predictor of outcome in college populations. And I think in the case of Warren's group, I think it was prescription opiate abuse, it predicts outcomes, intervention outcomes. So I know in the past, when I talk about money, people have reacted like, that's not very psychological. And psychologists tend to gravitate towards constructs that are have more to do with our personality attributes and so forth. But I would argue that people vote with their feet. You can tell what people value by what they do with their money, what they do with their time. They may tell you other things, but if you really want to know their preference structure, you look at what they do. And that's what behavioral economics fundamentally does.
Jaylee, it's just so amazing. When I first got into this interest area of delayed discounting, behavioral economics, I thought it was interesting, but I thought there's no way that these little behaviors of filling out forms in a lab can predict real human behavior. There's no way that asking someone how much they'd pay for a drink or how long they'd be willing to wait to get more money. I didn't believe that that it could have been externally valid, generalizable, and it's just striking at how predictive some of these behaviors in a lab are. It makes me wonder if treatment-incorporated activities where people estimated how much they'd be willing to spend for their particular drug of choice or addictive behavior of choice, I wonder if there's a way to integrate these activities that are so have proven to have so much effect or power in research. I wonder whether activities could be revolved around some of these.
For what it's worth, the addiction severity inventory, that's where Warren's group got their income data with their prescription opioid patient population.
The addiction severity inventory.
Index or whatever it's called. I mean, it's that old thing that's been around forever.
Okay, got it.
The ASI. And you don't have to ask them to estimate what they might do. You ask them what they've done, which is a far easier thing for people to answer. Like, okay, over the last month, what did you spend your money on? By category. And what we have found is the discretionary expenditure pool, if you look at that, because we're dealing with a natural recovery sample and they tend to be higher functioning in general and they tend to be working and have money. But if you look at what they're doing with the money that they can make choices in present time, the relative proportion that is allocated to buying alcohol versus put voluntarily into savings is predictive of outcome. When Jim Murphy's group did this, and again, this is out there in the recent literature with college students, they don't have to just separate this out as a discretionary expenditure pool. They can just look at absolute spending because students don't have the same kind of complex personal economies. What I'm trying to say here is that I don't think it's difficult to incorporate this, and I think we're already starting to see that in the clinical literature and certainly the treatment outcome studies that have been done that have looked at these behavioral economic predictors of outcome. They're easy to find in the literature, but now people are looking at actual monetary spending.
That's very, very interesting. I am looking at the time here, realizing it flew by.
It flew by.
With just a minute left, actually, I want to thank you so much, Jaylee. There is a particular sound that happens when people hang up, and there is one. Everyone has stayed on. I think one person hung up because they got the wrong number, but we've had well over 25 people on this call that you've captured and held our interest for the entire hour. I can't thank you enough for this. I hope people will look at that chapter, go to the website, get that chapter, read it. It's got tremendous information, but also great references if you want to read more. Jaylee, I'm quite certain that you'd be easy to reach if anybody wanted to find you. They could just look at University of Florida. Is there anything final you want to say as we wrap up?
The one thing I'll say is I've never gotten bored doing this, and I say that mainly for the students. Find something you're interested in. It'll keep you busy for a whole career.
I think that's so right. That's so right. Well, thank you again. Thank you to everybody for calling in. Tom, thank you for bringing a group with you. What a pleasure to hear your voice, to hear your questions, and to know that you are on the line with us.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Absolutely. All right, and this will be posted for anybody who wants to hear it again in just a matter of minutes. Thank you all. Jay Lee, thank you again.
Thank you, Bruce. Bye-bye
thank
now.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Dr.